I've got a real challenge now because they say that they've armed the alarms, and if I don't end my lecture on time, whoa, that's the way you got to treat somebody like me. I always go overtime. You know, there's so much material. I'm not here to apologize, you know, for the fact that I do speak so much and go overtime. But I would like you to know that it's because there is so much to share with you, to give you the courage and the confidence that you don't have to worry about these soundbite arguments that are thrown by the unbelievers at you. The Christian worldview has nothing to fear from anybody who comes on. And so that's what we're trying to demonstrate in our ministry and in this conference. And if I have too much material, it's just because there is so much material to share to give you that kind of confidence. Our last hour, let me see if I can pull this all together for you. The evolutionary theory is really a worldview, it turns out. It's a commitment people have made to understand themselves, reality, the course of history in a certain light. And all the evidence is going to be organized around that commitment. We've got a worldview as well. And from within our worldview, when evolutionists say, you know, these are the sorts of things that have happened, that looks utterly preposterous to us. It bothers us that the culture at large, though, says, oh, yeah, that's true, that's true. And then you bring these problems out in an academic setting, and they get marginalized. People say, oh, that's not really important, or this, that, and the other. You get the impression they're trying to run away from it all. So remember, it's not simply a matter of just putting the facts out there and, if you will, bludgeoning the unbeliever with facts. The facts, however, can be used to embarrass unbelievers and say, well, within your theory, don't you have a problem with this and with that? And the biggest problem of all, whether it's at the level of amoebas or apes or Adam, the biggest problem of all is that evolution ultimately requires you to believe in contradictions. That something that has this distinctive quality became its opposite. Just give us enough time and it will become its opposite. And so you need to believe in a contradictory worldview in order to be an evolutionist. That's the bottom line. Now somebody might say, but Dr. Bonson, don't you want an apologetic that makes people say that they're wrong? Well, it'd be nice if we had that, but it's impossible to have that. Because you see, the problem here is a spiritual problem. And as long as the heart of someone is not changed, if they want to persist in their absurdities, they will do that. That the only point that you can expect that people who have followed absurdities are finally going to give up is the day of judgment. And on that day, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. And some will confess with praise and some will confess, I'm doomed. So remember that you're doing the evolutionist a favor when you point out that his worldview commitment is not based on facts, really, ultimately. We've de-scientized evolution. It's a worldview, and a worldview that internally makes no sense. Now, somebody might say, having heard this, or maybe many discussions you have with them, they might say, well, obviously we need a creator God. But I don't have to be a Christian, because after all, there are other theories out there, creator gods. For instance, why should I follow the Bible? I mean, I could equally follow Islam. We run into people who do that. You know, they'll say, well, there are a lot of religions, and the only religion, we don't have time even to do Islam justice right now, but the only religion that really comes anywhere close to the basic structure of the Christian worldview is Islam. All the others have difficulties, like they have impersonal forces rather than a personal God, or they don't have a God who rules over matter, and on and on and on. We'll leave that to a lecture on comparative religion. But Islam, to some people, well, Islam's got a personal God, this God is sovereign, this God's the creator, and this God's revealed himself in a book. And so in many ways, that looks a lot like Christianity. And this leads people to that soundbite dismissal of your testimony to them. They'll say, well, it doesn't have to be Christianity, it could be Allah. Now, what should you do when people dismiss Christianity by saying, well, there are other options. Get down and dirty. So let's talk about those options. Let's talk about some details here. And what I'd like to do is to share some details about Islam with you tonight that you'll find helpful in conversation when you talk to people. I'm going to minimize my opening remarks. The first thing I want to tell you is that Islam has become a worldwide menace. The Islamic world comprises approximately 1 billion Muslims tonight, which is to say 1 out of every 5 people in the world is a Muslim. It's projected that within 25 years the Arab world will double. And the missionary outreach in the Muslim world is very meager. I have some statistics I think that would depress you to hear about this. In the United States, Islam is the 4th largest denomination, if you want to put it that way, having 6 million believers. That surprise you? Islam trails behind Roman Catholicism, the Southern Baptist, and the United Methodist. But that's it. It's the 4th largest distinct religious group in America today. Many European countries have extremely large Muslim populations. Last year when I visited London, one of the things that depressed me terribly is to see these old, beautiful Christian churches, one after another, have been purchased by Muslims and turned into mosques in grand old England. And we see the growth of Islamic fundamentalism in the Western world that's creating havoc in a socio-political sense all over the world. For the last 20 years, just think about some of the major events that have occurred. In 1972, the Munich Olympics, Israeli athletes were killed by Muslim terrorists. In 1973, we had the oil crisis. In 1973, the Arab-Israeli war. Then in 1979, the Iranian Revolution, the kidnapping of American citizens at our embassy. In 1981, Egypt's President Anwar Sadat was assassinated by Islamic fundamentalists. In 1983, American Marines were killed in Lebanon by Muslim terrorists. In 1990 and 91, we went through the Gulf War with Iraq. In 91 and 92, the Algerian people in a democratic election voted for a Muslim fundamentalist party to rule over them. In 1993, we had the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York City. And I'm just skimming the surface. These sorts of things happen over and over and over again. Last week when we did this seminar up in Orange County, I did this just randomly. I opened the paper, actually the day before I spoke, and there were 2 major stories. One having to do with this feminist writer who was granted bail, but she's returned to hiding. A feminist writer who spent 2 months in hiding after death threats from Muslim fundamentalists appeared in court under heavy police guard Wednesday in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. She was granted bail, but she had a hard time even getting that. She had come out of hiding. What was her crime? She had suggested that there was a need for changes. And, of course, it's thought that she said changes are needed in the Quran. She claimed she was talking about Islamic law, not the Quran. But it really doesn't make too much difference. The point is, the response of the Muslims was, that's not open for discussion. You've got to die. And although she came to court, she was convinced finally to come out of hiding so that she might have her day in court and let the courts decide her fate. It says here in the article on Friday, a crowd estimated by news agencies at 200,000 people gathered in Dhaka to support the militants' demands for Nareen's death. And one militant faction was reported to have formed a 100-man death squad to kill her. In the very same paper, we read that 5 more foreigners were slain in Algiers the same day. Islamic militants were suspected. Now that took me back, 5 people killed by them. But when I read the article, I hadn't, you know, kept track of this. And it says that that brings in this year alone the number to 56 foreigners that have been slain in Algeria since the Islamic armed group began attacking foreigners there last September. I'm not going to go through it all. You can look at USA Today, February 15th, 1993. Huge, detailed article about the problems of Islamic fundamentalism around the world. Now, there's a problem in what I'm doing here, because some people might say, well, this isn't fair, Dr. Bonds. You're deciding all these nasty accounts. You're trying to prejudice people against Islam and so forth. And it's especially thought to be illegitimate when you have people like Dr. Siddiqui, whom I debated a couple of years ago at Orange Coast College, who tell us that Islam, on its best interpretation, doesn't support this sort of thing. But that's just not true. Islam historically has never been, you cannot give me an illustration where Islam has ever been a force for political peace, except when they were in the minority. In every case when Islam has come to power, it has turned to death threats to keep people from turning away or from disagreeing. In Surah 2, chapter 2 of the Quran, we read, slay them wherever you find them and drive them out of the places they drove you from. Idolatry is worse than war, but do not fight them within the precincts of the mosque unless they first attack you there. If they mend their ways, know that God is forgiving and merciful, but fight them until idolatry is no more and God's religion is supreme. One of the most famous sayings attributed to Muhammad, the prophet of Allah and the founder of Islam, is, know that paradise lies under the shadow of swords. People may try to give Islam a peaceful interpretation, but they're going to have to fight against the Quran itself and its own wording and the universal history of Islam. And so this is not ordinarily my approach. I usually just look at the scholarly merits and so forth. But I want you to know we are dealing here with a worldview which is becoming a worldwide menace. It ought to concern you. With the fall of communism around the world, it's not completely gone, and I realize it might rise again, but in my conviction is that it's on its, you know, last legs and so forth. With the fall of communism, I believe that the greatest threat to the Christian church is going to be Islam in the next generation and perhaps beyond. There are many Muslims in our culture. You run into them. You see them in school. You'll see them in the market. My friend Steve Schlissel, who has a ministry in Brooklyn, says that recently in the Jewish press, an author by the name of Steve Walsh explained that traditionally Islam had defined both Jews and Christians as al-Kubah, the people of the book. But since the late 1980s, there's been a growing trend in Islamic thought which seeks to recast the relationship into one of hostility and confrontation. And in this article, he cites another publication, Islam versus Al-Qaeda by Maryam Jamilah, who was, by the way, originally an American. She converted to Islam and now lives in Pakistan. And here's what she writes, quote, the gulf that separates Muslims from Jews and Christians is so deep as to be unbridgeable. She goes on to say that it is now, under these circumstances, impossible that there ever be friendship between them. She says, Jewry and Christendom have joined hands to destroy us and all we cherish. And so she sets forth her anti-Christian thesis as that we should set the stage for a new wave of terrorism. And then she says, finally, we must crush the conspiracies of Zionism, Freemasonry, I don't know where that comes from, Orientalism, and foreign missions, both with the pen and with the sword, end of quote. Well, I realize there are people out there who are trying to put a kind face on Islam, and they won't appreciate me telling you these facts. They're going to tell us over and over again, these are aberrations, 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 aberrations. The problem is, when you have so many aberrations, the word aberration doesn't work anymore. These are not aberrations. When you have contemporary people who are reflecting the Quran itself, telling us we must with the sword crush the Jews and the Christians. You had better be concerned about this. In 1989, Bernard Lewis of Princeton University, one of the leading scholars of Islam in the world, offered a lecture, the Jefferson Lecture, for the National Endowment of the Humanities. And the publication of his lecture was entitled The Roots of Muslim Rage. And I have planned to read a good portion of it for you. I'm going to have to cut this down. Why is it that Muslims are so angry with America? Why is it that they label us the enemy of God? And he looks at different hypotheses. We've helped the Jews. The problem is we've helped the Arabs too, and we've made the Jews unhappy, but that didn't seem to win any favors, you know, from the Arab world. And so he goes through these various things, and it's interesting. When he gets done, he says the only thing that will account for it is that you have two worldviews that are incommensurable with each other. Isn't that great? I mean, it's not just Vantillians who talk that way. You know, here's somebody who's a secular scholar, who's looking at these things. He says they just see things so differently. Their way of life is so different that it cannot be brought together, especially when you remember that the way of life mandated in the Quran is Islamic rule of the world. Muhammad is the only great religious leader in the history of the world that we know of who was not only a prophet and a teacher, but also a ruler and a soldier. And he encouraged his troops to fight for God. He said that the enemies of any Islamic army are the enemies of God. And he promised that any soldier who died in battle against the enemies of God would immediately go to paradise and there have all the sexual pleasure he wants. That tends to motivate guys. He says, quote, Islam was never prepared either in theory or in practice to accord full equality to those who held other beliefs and practiced other forms of worship. And jumping to the end of this, I'd like to explain it to you. But he says that the real rage for the Muslim burns within. It's not socio-political. It's not outward. It's not economic. He says it's an inner attitude. This is no less than a clash of civilizations. That's his quote. Arising from an ancient rival against our Judeo-Christian heritage, our secular present, and a worldwide expansion of both. Now, the menace is there. I don't see how anybody who opens his eyes can not see it. So what do we do in this country? We invite a Muslim cleric to open in prayer the Congress in the United States. That tells you how far we have drifted from our Judeo-Christian origins, as people like to put it. And we have the great favor done by the people who make movies, putting out movies that make Islam look wonderful to children. Now people say, but on the other hand, you have things like the latest Arnold Schwarzenegger movie where you have these wild-eyed Muslims. The problem is they're presented in such a cartoonish, you know, way that you can't really take that seriously. But what have our children been shown? What, recently in this Disney film? What's the title? Throughout the movie, Allah's name is called upon. Right? It's just charming. This religion that's out to kill anyone who disagrees ultimately. Just charming. Now I ask you, in our culture, can you imagine the Disney studios putting on a charming little cartoon movie where repeatedly in the movie people call upon the name of God and the name of through Jesus? You know, that would be hammered immediately. You know that. That's politically incorrect. You can't put out that kind of propaganda. But when Islam does it, or when the nation of Islam does it, and the black militants among us do their things, the police in New York City stand by and they say, we're not going to get their rage against us. They can do what they want. You ought to be worried about this. What does Islam teach? I'm tempted to depart from what I wanted to do. I'm not going to. I'm just going to have to be brief about it. It'd be good if I could just give you a summary of what they believe, but then you might say, yeah, but you're prejudiced, Dr. Bonson. So what I brought is a little pamphlet entitled Islam at a Glance, written by the fellow that I debated, I believe, Dr. Siddiqui, and published by the Islamic Society of Orange County. So in their own words, I want you to hear what they believe. The Arabic word Islam means peace, submission, and obedience. Actually, Islam means submission, but peace got put in there in this little pamphlet. Isn't that interesting? The religion of Islam is the complete acceptance of the teachings and guidance of God as revealed to his prophet Muhammad. A Muslim is one who believes in God and strives for total reorganization of his life according to his revealed guidance and the sayings of the prophet. He also works for building human society on the same basis. It's the opening paragraph. What does this tell you, Christians? Islam is being presented as a world view based on divine revelation, whereby every aspect of life is to be reformed and society is to be reconstructed. I purposely choose that word. You need to understand that Islam presents itself in the opening paragraph. I mean, there's none of this private religion, you see, of the heart, just you and Allah talking to each other and going to heaven someday. Islam intends to reorganize all of life based on Allah's revelation. Islam is a world view. And now, in the next paragraph, continuity of message. Islam is not a new religion. It is, in essence, the same message and guidance which Allah revealed to all prophets. And now the pamphlet quotes the Quran 3:38. Say, we believe in Allah and that which has been revealed to us, and that which was revealed to Abraham and Ishmael and Isaac and Jacob and the tribes, and that which was given to Moses and Jesus and to other prophets from their Lord. We make no distinction between any of them, and to him we submit. And so the presentation here is, if you're a Christian, if you're a Jew, you have no reason to oppose us. We agree with you. Your great prophets are our prophets too. Muhammad is just delivering the message of Jesus and Moses and Abraham. Ishmael gets in there, but nevertheless, you see the thrust here is, we're continuous with you. You have no reason to fight against us. And if you do, you may get cut, but you have no reason to do so. Hebrews 1:1 says that God, in many ways in the past, has revealed himself, but at the end of the ages, has revealed himself, what, supremely, through his Son, Jesus. And so here you have Islam presenting a favorable view of Jesus, a favorable attitude toward Jesus, that in fact slaps him in the face, says, no, you are not the supreme revelation of God, Muhammad is. But if you are willing to step down, Jesus, and be part of the flow from Moses through the prophets to the supreme prophet, then of course there's a place for you. Well, can any Christian do that, given what our revelation says? Of course we can't. What are the five pillars of Islam? Be quick about this. First, the declaration of faith. To bear witness that there is none worthy of worship except Allah, and that Muhammad is his messenger to all human beings till the day of judgment. The prophethood of Muhammad obliges the Muslim to follow his exemplary life as a model. In a few minutes I'll tell you about this exemplary life. Secondly, prayers. Daily prayers are offered five times a day as a duty towards Allah. They strengthen and enliven belief in Allah and inspire man to higher morality. They purify the heart and prevent temptation towards wrongdoings and evil. Now, I haven't gotten through all the pillars, but does this sound moralistic to you? Well, that's because it is moralistic. There is nothing of redemption in Islam. There is talk of mercy from Allah, but as I've shown in previous lectures, if you'll do a textual study of the Quran, mercy is always mercy extended to those who will try harder. It's always mercy for those who will engage in what we call works righteousness. There is no sense of substitution, no sense of redemption. This is not a religion of salvation in the traditional sense. It's an eschatological, moralistic faith. On the day of judgment, Allah will accept you if you work hard to be a good person. The third pillar, fasting during the month of Ramadan. The Muslims during the month of Ramadan not only abstain from food, drink, and sexual intercourse from dawn to sunset, but also from, listen, evil intentions and desires. Do they really? You abstain from evil desires during the daylight hours. I just want to mention, now that's what I mean about getting down and dirty. When somebody tells you this, and I've talked to a number of Muslims, and they get very religious during this month and so forth, and they'll say things like that. They'll say, and we don't have any food and we don't have any sex until sundown. Be honest with you, I'm not terribly impressed with that claim, but okay. And we refrain from evil desires, to which you have to ask, you mean until sunset? Which is true. The fifth pillar of Islam, zakat, to pay annually 2.5% of one's net saving on which a year has passed as a religious duty, and purifying some, listen to that, a purifying sum to be spent on poorer sections of the community. And then finally, pilgrimage to Mecca. It is to be performed once in a lifetime if one can afford it financially and physically. Besides these pillars, every action which is done with the awareness that it fulfills the will of Allah is also considered an act of worship. Now, I find something fascinating. I'm running out of time. I've done a lot of reading about Islam, and I know the way this is presented. You have the five pillars that you presented almost always. And then every textbook presentation says it's five pillars and then there's another. Because universally, Islam teaches the doctrine of fate. Okay? That Allah determines all things in advance. Kismet. All right? And so I'm reading along in this popular presentation. We have the five pillars, and it says, besides these pillars, and I'm saying, okay, here comes Kismet. And in the place of Kismet, we read, every action done that fulfills the will of Allah is considered an act of worship. And I'm going, where's Kismet? It's not there. Islam enjoins faith in the oneness and sovereignty of Allah, which makes man aware of the meaningfulness of the universe and his place in it. This belief frees him from all fears and superstitions by making him conscious of the presence of the Almighty Allah and of man's obligations toward him. This faith must be expressed and tested in action. Faith alone is not enough. Belief in one God requires that we look upon all humanity as one family under the universal omnipotence of God, the creator and nourisher of all. Islam rejects the idea of a chosen people, making faith in God and good action the only way to heaven. Thus, a direct relationship is established with God without any intercessor. Now, in case you've missed the implication, between the lines, meaning, we don't need Jesus, thank you. We go directly to God based on our good works and confessing his name, praying, giving our purifying tithe, and all these other things. And then the next section is entitled, Man the Free Agent. What happened to Kismet? Fate. Man the Free Agent. Man is the highest creation of God. He's equipped with the highest of potentialities. He's left relatively free in his will, action, and choice. Relatively free? The doctrine of Kismet is one of the most ironclad deterministic teachings to ever have been put forth in the name of religion. God has shown him the right path, and the life of the Prophet Muhammad provides a perfect example. Man's success and salvation lies in following both. And now listen to this. Islam teaches the sanctity of the human personality and confers equal rights upon all without distinction of race, sex, or color. I bet that female author over there in India would like to know more about this. We don't have any discrimination based on sex. That's interesting. And then it endorses the law of God as applying to all men from top to bottom. And then it lists as the authoritative sources for Islam the Quran and the Hadith. And this gets into the last part of my lecture. I wonder if any of you have heard of the Hadith. You've probably heard of the Quran. The Hadith is an equally inspired, or at least on some presentations, inspired maybe at a lower level, but usually presented as the dual sources of Islamic belief. We read, the Quran is the last, revealed word of God and the basic source of Islamic teaching and laws. The Quran deals with the bases of creeds, morality, history of humanity, worship, knowledge, wisdom, the God-man relationship, and human relationship in all aspects. Comprehensive teachings on which can be built sound systems of social justice, economics, politics, legislation, jurisprudence, law, and international relations are important content of the Holy Quran. We're told Muhammad himself was an unlettered man who could not read or write, yet the Holy Quran was committed to memory and writing by his followers under his supervision during his lifetime. There's only one problem, and that's that the Hadith says otherwise. Yes, he was an unlettered man. And I'm not saying this in some kind of sarcastic way. But you have to understand that the people who compiled these two things had no idea of the number of conflicts that they had. And we still have today the story told that his followers memorized these things under his superstition during his lifetime. The Hadith tells us it was not done during his lifetime. You'll be told by Islamic apologists that the superiority of the Quran is found in the fact that it has a pure text, no textual variants. Well, you know, that is not even true today, but to the extent that it's true, if you read the Quran, you'll notice there are verses missing in every publication of the Quran today. Not hard to know why. In the caliphate of Uthman, the third caliphate among the Arabs, there were conflicts among the Muslims, whether Muhammad said this, Muhammad said that, different versions of the Quran, different orderings of the Quran, and so forth. And so Uthman first called them all in, and he declared an authorized version, kind of like the King James Version of the Quran. But then people were unhappy that things that they liked from what Muhammad said were not in the authorized version, and so they were unwilling to follow it. So he said, okay, since that doesn't work, I'll call all these copies in, and I'm going to burn the variant readings. And he threatened to kill anybody who wrote them out again. Well, okay, so you've got a pure text based on a recension upon threat of death. I'm not terribly impressed with that sort of thing. But what I find is extremely interesting is that the Hadith, which is supposed to be equally important in terms of a source of teaching, is not known by most people. And I'd like to share with you some of the things that are found in the Hadith. Before I do, I just want to point out that in this pamphlet, once again, our author speaks of Islam as a way of life. Islam provides definite guidelines for all peoples to follow in all walks of life. This guidance is comprehensive and includes social, economic, political, moral, and spiritual aspects of life. And there are other things that are said about that. The last paragraph of the pamphlet is entitled Unfragmented View of Life. Human beings live according to their view of life. The tragedy of secular societies is that they fail to connect the different aspects of life. The secular, the religious, the scientific, and the spiritual seem to be in conflict. Islam puts an end to this conflict and brings harmony to man's vision of life. Well, from beginning to end, the first paragraph to the end and scattered throughout, I hope you'll get this point. This is not, you see, some Christian presuppositionalist who's writing this. This is somebody who's promoting Islam and saying, of course we are a worldview. We have secular scholars who say, that's the problem. It's a worldview conflict, and it cannot be resolved. You can't have it both ways. One other thing from the pamphlet, then we're going to look at the Hadith. The pamphlet speaks of the history of Muhammad and then says he led a perfect life and set an example for all human beings as his life was the embodiment of the Quranic teaching. I'm taking this information from a nice little pamphlet published by a friend of mine, Dr. Robert Morey, An Analysis of the Hadith, where he just goes through and picks out things in the Hadith. I'd like to share a few of them with you. First, just to underscore the importance of the Hadith, even if you were not familiar with it, Muslim scholar Dr. Muhammad Hamadullah, in his book Introduction to Islam, says, quote, "The custodian and repository of the original teachings of Islam are found above all in the Quran and the Hadith." And then he goes on to say, "The teachings of Islam are based primarily on the Quran and the Hadith, and as we shall presently see, both are based on divine inspiration." Now, there's problems with the Quran in and of itself as a divine inspiration. Because the Quran, those of you who have heard my lectures before, I'll just give you a real quick thumbnail sketch. The Quran teaches that Allah revealed himself first through Moses and David and Jesus. And so they're willing to accept the revelations of these people. But the problem is that what God said to Moses is any future prophet may not contradict what has gone before. Jesus claimed to be the very Son of God, equal with the Father. The Quran contradicts what Jesus says. In fact, the Quran teaches that it's abhorrent, this idea that God would have a son. Allah would have a son. And so they present a view of Jesus that you won't find anything like the New Testament. Jesus was not crucified according to the Quran. Judas was substituted for him. The mother of Jesus is presented as the sister of Aaron, Moses' brother. And above all, the The Quran teaches over and over again that a person is right with Allah by doing good works. Well, you don't have to be a Christian very long to, I bet some of the first verses you memorize tell you that that's not the way we're saved, according to the teaching of the New Testament. Not according to the teaching of Moses. In fact, Moses taught what? Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. And the whole Jewish cult of the Old Testament was a bloody cult full of presentation, graphic presentation, that men are sinful and unclean and cannot come to God. In fact, the high priest alone could come into the presence of God, and only once a year, only with sacrifice. The Jews were so superstitious about that they tied a rope around the ankle of the high priest so that if he died in the presence of God, they could pull him out of the Holy of Holies without going in and dying themselves. God was separate from people because they were unclean, they were sinful, and they needed a mediator. And we've just read a presentation from a doctor of Islamic studies who says, we need no mediator. Well, again, time's short. I just have to tell you, you cannot reconcile the Quran with the Bible. And since the Quran says that it is continuous with the Bible, the Quran presents its own self-contradiction. The Quran tells us that all of Noah's family was saved in the flood, but that one of Noah's sons was drowned. No one ever bothered to look at Surah 21 and Surah 11 and see that they have conflict there. The Quran says that Pharaoh's wife adopted Moses. Of course, you know from the Bible, it was Pharaoh's daughter who adopted Moses. Zacharias is said to have been speechless for only 3 days in Surah 3, but of course Luke 1 says it was 9 months. Well, how many illustrations do I have to give you? You just cannot reconcile these two books. But the problem is worse than that. You cannot reconcile the Quran with the Hadith either. There are contradictions between them, and in fact, because of them, verses in the Quran can no longer be found. The Quran has been altered. And what does the Hadith tell us about Muhammad? Our author tonight says we're supposed to follow the example of Muhammad because he's presented as a sinless man. But according to the Hadith, he was not sinless. And I quote, this is something Muhammad said, what do you say in the pause between takbir and the recitation? Muhammad replied, I say, O Allah, set me apart from my sins as the east and west are set apart from each other, and clean me from sins as a white garment is cleaned of dirt. O Allah, wash off my sins with water, snow, and hail. In Hadith number 319 of volume 8, I heard Allah's apostle saying, by Allah, I ask for forgiveness from Allah and turn to him in repentance more than 70 times a day. Well, how do you bring these two together? Sinless Muhammad, Muhammad who prays for forgiveness 70 times a day. There's a conflict between the Quran and the Bible, but even worse, there's a conflict between the Quran and the Hadith. What sorts of things are taught in the Hadith? Well, notice the superstition that is taught here. Muhammad was afraid that evil spirits might enter his body whenever he urinated or defecated, and thus he prayed for special protection. Muhammad believed if you place a green palm leaf on the grave of those suffering in the grave, their pain would be lessened as the leaf dries up. Muhammad believed that people could be turned into rats, monkeys, and pigs. In particular, he claimed that the Jews were transformed into rats often. Is this a worldview you can take seriously? I don't think so. With respect to war and sex, I think you should know for discussion with people who say, well, you could have the Quran, you could have Islam as easily as you could have Christianity. Any Muslim who is killed while fighting in jihad will go straight to the sexual pleasures of paradise. Muhammad endorsed violence against his opponents, against apostates. And we read from the Hadith, volume 4, number 260, the Prophet said, if somebody discards his religion, the religion of Islam, kill him. And then real quickly, and this is getting down and dirty. I'm sorry to talk about some of these things. I hope there aren't many children in the audience tonight. But you need to know that Muhammad was obsessed with urination and defecation. He said, and any man who urinates on his clothing will go to hell. According to the Hadith, one of the major sins is not to protect yourself from urine, being soiled with it. Once the Prophet, while passing one of the graveyards of Medina or Mecca, heard the voices of two persons being tortured in their graves. You might be interested to know that. He could hear people being tortured in hell. The Prophet then added, yes, they are being tortured for a major sin. Indeed, one of them never saved himself from being soiled with his own urine. There are rules for urination and defecation in the Hadith. One, you must not face Mecca when you're urinating or defecating. You must not use your right hand to hold or to wipe yourself when going to the bathroom. You must wash your privates after going to the bathroom. And according to the Hadith, if you pass gas while you are engaged in prayer, Allah will not hear your prayers. According to Muhammad in the Hadith, Adam was 90 feet tall. Muhammad did not allow dogs. He said angels will not enter a house if a dog is there. And that's why at one point he had all the dogs in a community killed. And you might be interested in this little piece of what Robert Morey calls Islamic genetics. Why is it that children resemble their father or their mother? This is the inspired word of Allah through Muhammad found in the Hadith. If a man has sexual intercourse with his wife and gets a discharge first, the child will resemble the father. And if the woman gets her discharge first, the child will resemble her. What do spirits eat? Dung and bones. The angel Gabriel has 600 wings. Muhammad was found to be sucking water up his nose and blowing it out. Why? Because Satan stays in the upper part of your nose all night. If you eat garlic or onions and that smell is on your breath when you pray, Allah will not hear your prayers. And if you fall asleep when you pray, Satan will urinate in your ear. I don't like the scholarly approach of ad hominem making fun of people. And although we can have some fun laughing at these things, and I don't blame you for laughing, so don't take me wrong. But I want you to know I presented this to you because Islam is a total worldview. It claims inspiration. And when people tell you, well, they've got their inspired book, you've got your inspired book, what's the big difference? Say, we don't think Satan urinates in our ears. Or one of the other ones. That is, get down and dirty. When people start comparing, say, good, do the comparison. This may surprise many of you. If you get engaged in apologetics, sometimes about all you have to do is just say, compare the two systems. Now, if people have a heartfelt commitment to evolution or a heartfelt commitment to Islam, obviously they're going to back up. They're going to hear the stuff. They'll be incensed that I made you laugh about these things, these holy things. Even if they had not heard them, they'd say, well, I wouldn't have expected that. But that is what not the Bible, but that's what our holy book teaches. That's what we have to believe. They can regiment themselves and they'll say, we will not be refuted. We will not be ridiculed. These things are true. But that's not the majority of people you run into. The vast majority of people you run into, when they bring up the Quran, it's not because they are willing to defend it or they even know what it teaches. All you have to do is say, do you really think that you have comparable religions? And then give some of these examples from the Hadith. Give these contradictions. When all is said and done, you need to get down and dirty when people talk about Islam. Islam, the Muslims, are a menace, and you need to know that their message cannot be believed by any rational person. One has got to retreat to irrational faith to hold on to some of these ridiculous things taught in the name of inspiration. A Christian has nothing to worry about. So just let people look at it and say, well, here it is. D did you know these details? Did you know about evolution? Did you know about Islam? Tomorrow when we come back, I'm going to pick up on this claim, well, the Bible, you know, you can't be very sure about its text. And I'm going to try to teach you about the tremendous trustworthiness of the Bible and its text, so that people won't give you a sound bite to dismiss that either. Sorry for the rush tonight, and I do hope that you get enough out of this that you can use it when you get out talking to people. Tell them, let's just look at the details before you dismiss Christianity. Thanks.